this morning with the sundown shining in.
Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the f***ing money, head?
It's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
I found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses.
Hit it.
I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the new so, you know, that's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Illinois Nazis. I hate Illinois Nazis.
Now, let's cut to the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
I lost you $60,000. There is no one who wants to make that money back for you more than I do.
There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
What the f*** are you talking about?
Don't worry, nobody's listening anyway.
I woke up this morning with the sundown shining.
Well, welcome back to Faction Jacks. I'm talking about Ricky on the board. S&P futures, I'll get them in a second. I'm reading something very interesting. They're up like 450. I'm sorry, down like 450. Got something here to quiz Kevin about. But what young people think of a recession. S&P futures down 450, NASDAQ futures down 40. So Kevin's always hanging around a bunch of young people, and Ricky is a young guy. So I'm going to quiz the boat of them, as they say in the South Side.
I believe that's the boat he is.
The boat he is, yeah, the boat he is. I'm looking here at the... By the way, good morning, how are you?
Doing all right.
What'd you think of all the games last night? What'd you think of the Bulls buzzer beater?
I only saw highlights this morning, but the Bulls are a hot team. They've won, you know, like eight out of ten or something like that.
Somebody's hypnotized them into they're not. They don't think they're crummy. They think they're better.
You know what? I for better and for worse, they have a group of people who fit together, who play the same style and play the style Donovan wants them to play.
And they seem like they don't mind.
Which has always been a lot of running.
Yeah, they also seem like they enjoy playing with each other.
Yeah.
And nobody's hogging the ball. Nobody's watching Zach LaVine shoot.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, maybe I'll have to tune in and actually watch a Bulls game one of these days. Not that they're on TV where I am, but.
Speaking of which, I don't think Comcast still hasn't cut the deal with the Chicago Sports Group.
That's why they're not on where I live.
All right. Well, they're not on. Neither are the Sox. Of course, I'm not so sure they're a big. Push, but anyway, they're not on either. So it's the Sox, the Bulls, and the Hawks that are not on Comcast.
Just oh, saying. My.
Yeah,
oh,
well, just saying.
The Tigers, the Bears, never mind.
Yeah, anywho, I'm looking at the interesting what people, you know, first of all, for people who remember back in the day, a recession is defined as two quarters in a row of shrinking gross domestic product, right? Now, how you define that, you know, you can basically pull it out your behind. Speaking of which, today the PCE number comes out, which is the Fed's favorite inflation thing because they won't tell anybody how they get there. So if you go to if you're growing at 1% and your inflation's 4, all you have to do is tell everybody that your inflation's really half of 1%, and guess what? You're still growing. You're not in a recession. So it becomes a little fuzzy when you start fuzzing up all the rest of the numbers. But I noticed a couple things this week. First of all, Kevin, I saw a commercial again last night. The NCAA is running. Don't get mad at your players if you don't get mad at the players if you lose your bet. What genius thought that up?
It's probably appropriate as a message, but on the other hand, you know, isn't that one of those things where you say, yeah, I know it's appropriate, but geez, don't say it out loud.
Yeah, I mean, what does that mean? We're so up the ass at gambling that now we have to embrace it and stuff and try and teach people how to gamble better or something? And what by the way, is it okay?
How to gamble without killing other people.
Well, who are you supposed to reserve your venom for? The coaches and the refs?
I don't think you reserve your venom. I don't think you're supposed to have venom because this is just a fun activity. You're not, you know, you're not really hurting anything.
It says you're not supposed to be mad at the players. Didn't say you weren't supposed to be mad at all.
Be mad at yourself for making stupid ass votes?
Well, no, nobody's gonna do that.
Bets, I mean.
Nobody's gonna do that.
Or votes, for you know, for that matter.
Nobody's gonna do that. Never, it's never your fault. It's always somebody else's, right? We don't.
Yeah, you got it. You got to have Ricky get that clip of John Belushi. In Blues Brothers when Carrie Fisher finally catches up to him and
it wasn't my fault.
All the reasons why it wasn't his fault.
Yeah. God. The other is I was surprised. One of the biggest sponsors. Not, I don't know if they're the biggest, but I saw an awful lot of Wendy's commercials. Now this is of the young people. If I could quiz them, and they're. Every single commercial that I saw on Wendy's, all they did was advertise their dollar burgers. They didn't mention anything on the regular menu. Do you find that odd? I mean, I know it's a...
Yes and no. The no part of it is everybody talks about, you know, when you talk about the expense of living today, and one thing that always comes up is I can't even take my kids out for fast food anymore. You know, if I have two kids and we go family and we want to go to McDonald's, we're not walking out of there for less than $30 bucks or so.
Well, when I was having all this construction done at the house, and my guy who does it brings his son and his nephew, right? And they, you know, these guys are terrific, but the kids like to eat what they like to eat. So every Saturday for like 6 weeks in a row, I had to haul my ass up to the Chick-fil-A. Now, the guy gets a salad. The kids get one of the sandwich meals. But the sandwich meal, no way is it enough for an 18-year-old kid who's working all day. So they end up with a big thing of the chicken strips or something a piece, and then maybe an extra fry or something. All together... You and I could have eaten the whole bag when we were younger, Kevin. I mean, there's not much there. It's never less than $75, and that's it includes the drinks, you know, the meals. But it's never less than $75 for three people. And this is lunch, and it's chicken. How much? Yeah. What's chicken breast on a bad day? $2 a pound, $2.50, maybe three. I mean, there could be a pound and a half of chicken in the whole bag, maybe.
Maybe.
Yeah, maybe. And I think that's a little... But anyway, this is sort of interesting. This is written by Alex Herring. And I don't know why this caught my eye there this morning, because I'm always trying to figure out what is a recession these days. For the chronically online, indicators can range from the perceived fall of fake eyelashes to more commercials for online colleges, or maybe it's skincare companies. Or it's skincare companies selling eggs. Literally running my, and this is, it's, they look to see what the commercials are. And it says, this trend also underscores a uniquely sharp sense of financial dissatisfaction among America's young adults. And I have to say that as we've gone through, as people have come and gone on the show in terms of producers and stuff, and I meet some of the people. Somehow or another, lately, Kevin, I've met a lot of younger people who work for our adult beverage group includes a few people that work for the OCC and the CBOE and so forth, and a couple of the bigger firms. Well, now, you know, some of the younger guys and girls that work with them are coming out, and I'm meeting them. Kevin, the view of the world going forward is so different than when you and I were young. I mean,
A little jaded, you think?
No, it's just they've got these jobs, and they're working, and it's, you know, it's a, I'm not saying it's a dead-end job, it's they're working in compliance somewhere, or financial reg, or something, or an OCC where you're trying to match up, you know, closing prices and those kinds of things, and they're real jobs, but they're I'm going to say 50, 60 a year. I don't even know, but that would be my guess. And, you know, and you got to look decent, come to work, and maybe it's a little more than that. I don't even know if it's a little more than that. They're absolutely convinced that no way on earth am I buying a house ever, and no way on earth am I buying a new car, like, ever. Not to mention having a family paying, you know, $70,000 a year for some kid to go to college. I mean, their whole view of their future is so different than ours. I mean, hell, what was a car when we were that age? $4,000, and we were making at least 16, 18, 20 somewhere in there. Even if, you know, even when, like, a regular job.
I can remember buying used cars for the you know, that we counted the price in hundreds.
Oh yeah. Well, I there were we had a shindig back when the traders were making a lot of money, right? They had one of these disease things. When I say disease things, it was some benefit for some disease, basically, over at the old stadium, a basketball tournament, people on the trading floors. This is all the guys from the Merck and the Board of Trade and everybody who had dough, right? And a few teams from the SIBO, so I sponsor a team. We go over there, and I'm supposed to be a sub, because I had kind of retired from basketball. For me, if you didn't play basketball 3-4 days a week, you couldn't play, right? I was never good enough to play once a month and be good. So anyway, one of our guys gets hurt in the first game, so of course I'm in, right? I end up playing all day long as people got hurt all day. So somewhere along the line, we didn't have a game. And I'm walking around all sweated up, and the guy goes, BMW sniffed out that all these traders were over there. So they got the permission of the stadium to bring a bunch of cars into the walk-around area. So the guy says to me, hey, how about hopping in this BMW, trying on for size? You'll love it. And look at the price. This is back when they had the luxury tax? Remember that fiasco?
Oh, yeah.
Well, the thing was like $60,000. It was this beautiful BMW. And I go, hey, I'm all sweated up. Ah, that's all right. That's leather. We'll just wipe it off. No, I'll stay out of the thing. and then the guy goes, the luxury tax is like $10,000. And the guy goes, won't you think? Don't you think it's nice? And I go, buddy, this is America. nobody should be killed for selling a car for $70,000 that wasn't nice. But I tell you what. And he says, well, what do you think? And I said, you know what I think? I said the $10,000 for the luxury tax is more than I've paid for the four cars I've owned total. The guy looks at me like, where did I find this bumpkin, right? But I had a couple of used trucks. I had nice cars. They just always were used, like you say. Get them, fix them up. I had a couple guys that would fix them up, and all of a sudden you're driving them around. We had, when Dr. J and I and this other dude lived in the house down south, in Beverly, we had he had a Corvette. We had a Firebird with the T-tops. We had a limousine. I had a GTO. I had a Ford Bronco. And the other guy had some funky old Plymouth. The guy next door says, by the way, I watched the neighborhood. Which one of these cars is yours? And I go, well, they're all ours. And he goes, well, what do you do with all these cars? I said, well, a couple of them don't go too far. Dr. J's Corvette, he says, it's a frame-up restoration. Of course, they sort of stopped halfway through. They didn't hook up the defroster, the heater, anything like that. Anyway, we had a bunch of cars in front of the house. But no, this idea that I look at the used car prices just out of yucks, they're going up every day. My niece was in an accident, and she got the money from State Farm after fighting with them. I think she had 2025? It was like a 2012. Maybe Corolla or something, nice Toyota or something, meticulously cared for. After they gave her the check, she's probably $6,000 away from getting anywhere near the same year as nice as that car. Not even close. Pretty scary, isn't it?
Well, I got to tell you, I had my car dealer that I've worked with before just sent me a text and said, we just knocked down the price on a year-old Chevy Malibu. It's $19,000.
Yeah, well, wow.
That's lower than I would have expected and higher than I would have ever paid for it.
Well, she gets whacked for something.
It's only a year old, so that wouldn't be a bad price in today's market.
Well, she gets whacked by some guy. I don't know if he was racing or what he was doing, coming home from volleyball. Gets whacked hard enough to go up on the sidewalk, right? And she was blacked out for a second, and all of a sudden, there's a guy who stops to help her and says, come on over in my car, and his car is surrounded by three or four people screaming that if she testifies against this guy, they're going to kill her. This is a Blackmore house. They take the guy, he must have been hurt. They take him to the hospital. She never got any, I don't think she ever got any information as to whether he was drunk, whether he had an insurance company or anything. I don't think he was insured. I don't know if the car was stolen. Never got any info whatsoever. So she had to fight it out for State Farm for her price of her car, which is way short. No, I don't know. There's a court case. I mean, it's unbelievable, Kevin. Nobody gives a crap about anything. If you're so far outside the law that you don't pay any attention to it, there's nobody can come at you. I mean, really, at any level, Washington or here or any place. It's unless you're somebody who, you know, like the dude who just got what's his name, Madigan. Unless you actually get your suit on and go to court and cooperate, they almost can't do anything to you. It's a bizarre world. Just saying. So what do you make of anxious to talk to you? Because I talked to my buddies between, you know, Bill Moriarty was on, and he's a big Marquette guy. And obviously, we go back and forth on the Notre Dame stuff. This is regarding basketball now. Well, for a long time, my other friend Bill, my attorney buddy, who's a big-time Marquette guy, went there on a football ride. How long ago was that? They're convinced now that they're going to have to start ponying up to compete. And a lot of people are they're not happy about it, but they're maybe willing to do it. And I just, you know, I don't know. I was going around and around with Russell and other people. I just don't know if every school is going to be an Auburn or Alabama, and it gets, or an Arkansas that's just so important to them that they're willing to hire somebody that, you know, maybe is kind of shady and he needs a lot of money, and, you know, they're the coach is not supposed to know about the NIL, but it looks like they're the ones that are making the deal. I mean, is everybody going to go down this rat hole or what? Or do you have to, or is there going to be some pullback? Or are we going to see the same 15 teams in the NCAA every year?
Probably, but let's step through that. So the shady coach thing is just indicative of a lack of values, and any business that is going to hire people who don't have integrity will eventually pay for that. It doesn't matter. It will be a problem. It may be a net positive from a cash flow base standpoint. But by the time they get rid of the person, but there's going to be some kind of embarrassment. And I guess if their fans, who would be their customers, don't care, fine, good for them. Have fun, enjoy your miserable life. But if you really, you know, there isn't a business alive that if you don't run it with integrity, that it, you know, can continue that way indefinitely. It just doesn't work. So, you know, we can think of ones that have been around a long time and say they're snakes, but, you know, that reputation is going to hinder it. Okay, let's set that aside. That's different. Yeah, are we at a point, you know, St. Francis College in Pennsylvania has decided that they're going to leave Division I and downshift because they can't keep up with this. Are we at a point, you know, where it's only going to be major conference schools in the in the round of 16? We could be there. Well, we are there now, but we could be there indefinitely. I don't know where the Big East fits in.
I was just going to ask you, where does the Big East fit in there?
The SEC is a couple of years back. They were having their, you know, their annual meetings, and from their commissioner on down, and a big push with the athletic directors was, they said, guys, you have all this football money, we could kick ass in basketball too, you just have to take some of that football money, that the ungodly amount of football money you're getting, and you have to start spending on basketball. And that's what they did, and that's been successful. Now, when they got in the tournament, you know, and I think you mentioned this on the air, or I mentioned it, or both of us mentioned it, the top of the conference all advanced and the bottom of the conference didn't. Well, that's kind of what you'd expect. I think the NCAA might want to look at eligibility and what they choose, because when you start choosing, you know, when you choose 14 teams and half of them have losing records in the conference, you have to wonder, you know, you're not supposed to take teams with losing records anyway. Why would you take people with losing records in their conference? and the justification is that the conference is great, and maybe the conference is great because they beat up on all those other teams. You can play chicken and egg with that. So there may be ways to tweak that and keep this interesting, but I don't think there's a lot of interest in tweaking it and keeping it interesting. I think there is a lot of interest in a 60-ish, maybe 48, maybe 60, 68, but some smaller number of people that make up a Division I super conference, because that's where the money is, and it doesn't have anything to do with college. It's all about just running a pro sports franchise that just happens to have a brand name that goes with it that is a university, and that therefore attracts a lot of alumni interest, you know, that creates its own customers based on the brand name of which the sport is only tangentially associated.
Well, what if you were to do business 101 on this, and I was actually thinking about this last night when I was watching some of the games. I mean, who is the over the years, who is the customer? And when you think about it, I look at the place I'm most familiar with, obviously, is Notre Dame. Well, talk about people who have I come from two different directions on this. I mean, how many people went to Notre Dame and then went to the University of Chicago? Talk about two diametrically opposed positions on sports, right?
Yeah.
And both are successful in being a university. Well, I mean, when I was in college, the customer clearly were the students, the alumni, and pretty much everybody was Catholic from the South Side, right? And that was your Notre Dame, and they had a very big, they had one of the few schools that had people that came there from pretty much all over the country, so they had this base. They used to call them the Subway alumni. The Chicago people never went there, but just liked the place. But it was, you know, it was a warm feeling towards a place where a real lot of kids from the South Side ended up going there, and the North Side too. I mean, the Chicago, the feed into the place for Catholic kids was huge. So you could see where their base came from and why they wanted to beat Southern Cal and places like that, because they were always the Goliath, and we were always the David, right? You know, when we went out and played Army in 1930, whatever the hell it was, I mean, they had to pack lunches and go on the train from the dining hall because they had money to pay people to eat out there, but they beat Army, you know, which was a huge deal. So, but it was always this Davy-Goliath thing, and you got this, and now you've got this, are the customers people from the school? Are they other students? It's not like when Robin went to Michigan, she said even when they were doing a demonstration, even the SDS called off the demonstration and went to the football game. I mean, it was a massive Michigan. They were the customers. You knew the people.
The state of Michigan is interesting as a who's the customer type of thing, because if you look at the University of Michigan, it is Michigan alumni and you know, of course, students and so on, but it's also people in the state of Michigan cheering for our state university. Now you can flip that over to Michigan State, and that ain't the same. Michigan State will have its fans around the state of Michigan who have no other affiliation with it, but by and large, Michigan State fans are Michigan State alumni.
Well, Ohio State's the entire state. I mean, that's
Ohio State is like the University of Michigan, only they don't have an you know, they have Ohio University, but it's not at that same level, so you don't have any reason to have a divided loyalty. You would think, you know, in Michigan, you would think they have two Big Ten schools, that you would have a whole lot more Michigan State fans who just have no other affiliation with the school, but that's just not the case. You know, it's Michigan and then the Michigan State alumni. Now, I'm overstating that. Yes, there are some Michigan State fans scattered around the state, but it's not the same. And then when I lived in St. Joseph, it was that, and then there was a pocket of Notre Dame fans because we were close to Notre Dame.
Well, then you've got Nebraska with no pro team.
Yeah.
Iowa kind of the same way. Minnesota.
And Iowa's another example, though. You have Iowa and Iowa State.
Yep.
Iowa State does not have the same kind of loyal in-state, you know, loving following that the University of Iowa has. It, you know, so that when you talk about who the paying customer is, the ones that buy tickets, you can look at Notre Dame and say, who's your paying customer for football? Who do you think that is, Tom? Who's the big paying customers for football?
I'm saying it's the alumni. But
it's the alumni. And how many alumni, including many of our friends, make the annual, the once a year, we have a pilgrimage back for a game weekend, and they build a whole game weekend experience around being there. And so occasionally you get some people in Chicago who will attend several games, or people, Chicago, Indianapolis, Grand Rapids, any of the local areas.
Well, that used to happen more often when the games were all the same time.
Yeah, and that was absolutely true. And you had a lot more non-alumni, people I knew from Chicago who would drive down knowing they'd get a ticket right before, game time and get in and see a good college football game. Not so anymore. So football is built around people who are willing to spend a ton of money for a weekend. And so you get the hotels gouge, planes, everybody's going to buy a ticket. They can charge you a lot of money for a ticket because nobody's going to travel without a ticket, especially in these days of electronic ticketing, because it's such a pain in the neck. You're not to do a swap in the parking lot if you want to buy somebody's extra ticket. Basketball is 100% different. College basketball at Notre Dame is all about the local fans.
Well, it's also horrible weather.
Well, it's weather, so you're not going tailgating, you're not building an experience around it, but you're also not going on Wednesday night. Wednesday night is I'm going to go watch a game, and then I'm going to go home because I have to go to work tomorrow, or kids have to go to school tomorrow, and so on. So it's more games. It's the days of the week, it's the times of the day, it's everything about it is a whole different audience for marketing. And some of the, people feel an affiliation to the school because it's local, but I will tell you from a basketball standpoint, more people in South Bend are Indiana University fans than they are Notre Dame fans for basketball. They're Notre Dame football fans, they're Indiana basketball fans.
Well, yeah,
and then they want Notre Dame to do well, but they're there's no really strong pull. So the basketball better be good.
Well, now that we walk into this NCAA experience, now the fans there, nobody cares what school you went to, right? It's all about your betting and your bracket and maybe watching some good games. Nobody cares if the coach is cheating. I don't think anybody does.
Apparently not.
Yeah. You were part of the stuff, in school. You really didn't want if all of a sudden you had somebody who was a total crook, or people went out and shot somebody from the football team or something, it kind of reflected back on you. I don't think anybody feels that way anymore. But I had a debate with, by the way, SP Futures down 10, NASDAQ Futures down 67, not doing too much here. We will go to our second break, but I sent the thing around yesterday, and I was talking to Lou, and Lou's this phenomenon, and I sent out that email yesterday, Kevin. It's like,
yeah, I sent your response.
Well, the thing that everybody knows it's true, but nobody really knows if it's true or not, kind of a thing. Everybody's convinced that, when I say everybody, anybody who likes sports is totally convinced that academic excellence brings huge money to a place in the long run. I don't think I'm going to debate.
You're saying athletic or academic?
Athletic. It brings money to the place for academic, for the foundation, for everything, and huge numbers that if you got rid of your athletics, you wouldn't have it. And I'm not going to debate the fact that if Notre Dame wins a national championship, or Indiana, or someplace, that you might have a bulge that year, certainly in the money that's maybe donated to the athletic departments or something. But I just wonder, over a period of 25 years, when you look at the schools that really emphasize athletics versus those that don't, and you look at some of the bigger donations that go to the places for whatever, medical research, whether it really matters near as much as people like us who love sports think it does. And I'm starting to think it doesn't. I one of those schools, and I shouldn't do this to Russell, but I'm going to say that Indiana's never won squat since Bobby Knight left, right? And yet...
Actually, they do have a national championship, but okay.
Okay, but what I'm saying is, over the last 25 years, they've gotten like 20 or 30 of their biggest donations. They're doing terrifically at getting money for academia.
Mm-hmm.
And I bet if I looked at Nebraska, it might be going the same way. Or they haven't had a national championship since you and I were kids, for God's sake. And I don't know, do they even have? I guess they have a basketball team, but they suck too.
They haven't done very well since they joined the Big Ten.
Yeah, but I'm saying is it really this? We got to have it, especially when the person that I have a conversation with. This is not, you know a fact, and you're going to berate somebody who doesn't. If you ask somebody, I looked at this by chance, UCLA can't get squat unless they have a winning basketball or football team. Well, yeah. Do you have any idea what the budget is of UCLA? What do you mean? I mean, what do you think the budget is? I have no idea. Would you believe $11.6 billion? The place is a friggin' city, for God's sake. With all kinds of stuff going on, hospitals and research and you name it. Do you think the thing runs only because they got a basketball team? Just because you and I happen to like... I guess I'm trying to get some perspective around this as we go down this road, Kevin. We've got this... Some people feel that if Alabama doesn't win, somehow Alabama's going under. No, it's not. I mean, some people are taking this to an absolute extreme, I think.
Well, I think so. I think it varies school by school. I mean, one of the things I told you is, remember the surge of just general interest, alumni interest, when DePaul got good in the 1980s.
Yeah.
Because it was just considered basically a commuter school, not a destination, and the commuters weren't all that engaged. It's sort of like, I went to IIT for grad school. I don't feel any strong affiliation for IIT. I don't do anything with them. It was a really good education experience, a really good, technology oriented business curriculum, and I'm really happy I went there and did it. But I don't feel a connection, and I think that's how DePaul was, and I think you find a lot more DePaul alumni got connected when basketball became big there, and it probably did a lot to drive their emphasis on residents, on getting more residential students, and you know how that's built up over the years.
Well, there's a question you just brought up.
Basketball driving the bus now? God, I hope not.
Well, I mean, it's a question I have. Let's talk about DePaul for a second. For those that don't know, DePaul is a Catholic school in the north side of Chicago, like a block from where I live. Nice neighborhood, nice place. You would never guess it is by far the biggest Catholic university in the country. Way bigger than Notre Dame, way bigger than Georgetown, way bigger than Loyola. And they had the Alumni Hall was their basketball place there, and the guy used to work for me on the trading floor was a star there, actually, Tom Tracy. And there were people that I used to play ball against that played there. Small gym, and yet there's enough of a taste, Kevin, and they've managed to screw this up, talk about define your customer, like no place I've ever seen. They've played out by O'Hare for a while. Well, now, the neighborhood I live in, I think, to a person, kind of loves DePaul. They love being in a university neighborhood. So why these guys, and now they're playing over by McCormick Place, why these guys do not have a 15,000-foot small arena? I mean, you don't need that huge of a footprint for that. In the neighborhood, when they have all this property, why they didn't put something there, I'm going to say that 40% of the people that I know in the neighborhood would be dying to have season tickets, walk over to watch a game and go to a bar afterward for a drink. They absolutely could get exactly what the Irish baseball team does with the South Bend people. That would be our team. I mean, and they've done everything possible to not let that happen. Well, what is the point of that?
And Loyola did the opposite.
Yeah. Well, Loyola's not in the greatest of neighborhoods. You're not going to get a 12,000-person walk-in crowd from Loyola. There's 100,000 people that live within, four blocks of where they would put this DePaul thing.
Yeah, but if you were to look at the local alumni base, Loyola's got a huge alumni base, and just like DePaul does, it's local. And you're right. They've sent them out to Rosemont, which you know, it was a completely bad idea, and now they're downtown by McCormick Place and Knights Arena, and I know, you know, I do know some people that go to their games, and you can get some goody Big East basketball, but unless they're really good, they're not filling up that arena. And it would be, you know, it could be the perfect place for people to do something after work, who work downtown. Does anybody still work downtown besides you?
There's actually the North Loop and the West Loop, yes. South Loop, not so much. But maybe trickling back a little, Kevin. Maybe.
But even so, because it's real easy. College basketball is a nice evening out because it only takes 2 hours.
Well, the first thing you do when you become a DePaul student, because my nephew went there, well, not because he went there, they have
my son went there too.
Well, they have the big campus downtown and a big campus in Lincoln Park. First thing you do is give you a pass on the red line. You go back and forth on the L. You're a city kid. Well, why would you have your arena anywhere that isn't on the red line? I mean, you just wonder when people make these decisions. What are they doing?
As strategists, they suck.
Yeah. And I'm saying when we walk into this new level, that we're gonna be paying all these people. I don't think the DePaul fans, honestly, football maybe. I don't think the Irish have a big stomach for this, paying every basketball player. I don't think the Irish care that much about it. Do you? They sure as hell aren't gonna have a problem.
They have this feeling that basketball's a cesspool, and they really don't want to get. You know, you talk about half a gangster, but they really only wanted to be half a gangster at any given time. I think they're actually, from the payment standpoint, I think they've become competitive into what they're as to what they're paying the basketball players now. So I don't think that's their issue anymore. I also think that if I were running that program, I wouldn't just be looking to get the payments to them. I would be looking to promote them, because Notre Dame is really, really good at promoting when they decide they want to promote something, and you're seeing it with the women who are quite charming. Where, you know, everybody knows Olivia Miles and Hannah Hidalgo and so on. So and they, you know, heck, they have, you know, their clothing lines. They have all kinds of stuff. They do a reasonably good job of promoting their football stars. They just don't sink the effort into the basketball program. And, you know, I would take a guy like Marcus Burton, and I would, you know, I don't care if I have to have him on only local commercials. I would start getting his face on TV and building something for him so that, you know, so that others see that. If I really wanted to attract players, I would say, we aren't just going to be competitive in what we pay you. We're going to help you build up an image that will allow you to continue to earn.
I also, when the NCAA actually was some sort of a disciplinary organization, I'm thinking they are not even anywhere near that now. I think the Irish always had an issue that there's no way the basketball team would ever be caught doing something that would affect the football team. That would cause, like, the school to be on probation or something like that. That was never going to come from the basketball team.
So, sort of like Illinois or Indiana not letting the football team damage their basketball program.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. But, you know, I just wonder if you were to take, you know, Russell maybe, you know, I bet he has the access to do this. If you were to take, over the last 25 years, the growth in the endowments of the teams that absolutely will do anything to have a great football team, but maybe a good basketball team. I don't think basketball is the same way, though. I mean, I don't think, you know, I don't think. Well, whatever. But where if you were
the only thing I can say for it, Tom, is it's alumni engagement. You know, yeah. We go back to who that customer is. It's just another way to engage them and to keep them writing checks. Are those the big checks that you get from foundations and the like? So when you start talking about percentage of the budget. But remember how Notre Dame used to sell football tickets to alumni.
Yeah, we had to pay them, give them $100
for it. They were a scarce commodity. You couldn't get them unless you were in the alumni ticket lottery. And the only way you got in there was you wrote a check for a minimum amount. And you could get a better lottery chance by writing a bigger check. So that ain't the truth anymore. There's always tickets that go on general sale now.
Do you think the
stadium, and they changed all the times to really screw up attendance.
Well, it's also if anybody ever know in their lifetime a restaurant that you absolutely couldn't get into, maybe had 10 tables or 12 tables or something, all of a sudden one day they doubled and like 2 years later were out of business because once you get in there, nobody cared? The phenomenon with the Blackhawks, with the United Center versus the old stadium. The old stadium held, what, 18,000 or something? Maybe they stuffed more than they should have, standing room. But you couldn't get a ticket there. And as soon as the Hawks went to the new place, which seats, what, 23 or something, when all of a sudden you could get a ticket at the same time, they sort of sucked for a while and do again. God, I went there with my cousin to a game one night. I didn't think there was a game that night, Kevin. There could have been 6,000 people there. Once you could get a ticket, nobody was interested. And everybody's convinced that the Bears absolutely need a stadium that seats more than 60,000 people. If you give one that anybody can get in, what makes you think anybody's going to go? People are weird, right? I mean, a lot of times...
Well, yeah.
I mean, I think...
That's a standalone statement, by the way.
And I think the same thing, to a certain extent, happened in Notre Dame. When they were 59,075 or wherever it was, you could never get in. Now they've made a place 80,000, and guess what? You can get in.
Yeah, you can get in. So, and then, you know, remember, you actually could get in because you could all, like I said earlier, you could always go down on game day and there would be, you know, if you just hung around outside the stadium, there were people with extra tickets and you could get into the game. That's not true anymore. They also said,
well, there are no tickets.
Games are at 1 o'clock, so you could have you could do a day trip from any small city in maybe 3 hours driving distance. You could make the game into a day trip, and so they had a lot of those people. And all of a sudden, the scheduling, these 3:30 games, 3:30 Eastern time games that spill into the night, nobody wants to make a day trip of that because by the time you get out of the game and you get out of the lots and you get yourself home, it's midnight. So that doesn't work real well. They just killed a lot of their attendance, and instead they've just made it, you know, the people who go now are the weekend experience, and then there's a few people who will still day trip. It's not zero, but they probably at least cut that in half, and maybe more than half were taken out of the equation. And you know, so that's part of why tickets are available too.
Well, the there was a guy,
extra space, poor start times, night games. You know, night games. What are you going to do about night games? That's that's its own issue.
There was a guy at Pullman when I was there named Tom Fenske, nice guy, and his son might have been on the trading floor. Anyway, but Tom, he was a big guy. I think he might have played for Michigan. I don't know if he was a star or not, but. You know a lot about. I mean, I never really talked to him about it, but I think they lived up kind of where you guys, Northbrook or someplace, maybe Mount Prospect, somewhere in that area. Every single game, I think they started at what, 1 o'clock or whatever. He had it down to the gnat's ass. They would pack the car up the night before. I mean, not really even pack the car up, but in case they had ran into weather or something, they would leave at like 5:30 or something, drive to Michigan, be there an hour before game time, have their, you know, little bit of a tailgate and all that stuff, watch the game, get in as soon as they could, they'd start driving home, have dinner along the way at Skip's Other Place or one of those places along that. They used to get all this traffic of all the games from Notre Dame and Michigan, made it home by 10 o'clock. He couldn't wait to go every week. I can't imagine today, this week it's 3 o'clock, this week it's 6, he wouldn't be going. I don't think. Now, whether they care or not, that's another story, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, but it's... Hey,
I used to do that for Notre Dame games on Saturdays. You know, that was a day trip. Even when I was in high school, and we played our high school football games on Sunday, so there would always be a Saturday morning practice. A friend of mine's father had season tickets and didn't like to go to games, but still held on to the tickets. So Bob and I went to, he would just come over as soon as practice was over. And it was walk-through, type of practice, lightweight before the game. And we'd jump in the car, we'd go down to the game. I'd be back home by 8 o'clock at night and, ready to get a good night's sleep before playing football on Sunday.
Hey, we have a few minutes left. We've been talking maybe too much sports, but what does... I was talking to some people last night, and I've been trying to do some work on these tariffs, Kevin, but it's such a a cesspool of what's actually going to be the, you know, what's actually going to work happen. I mean, it's last I heard, where I have no idea why the Buick Envision has become like a security thing now or something where you can't import those. I don't get that part at all, but I can't figure out the math on any of this stuff. I mean, I don't know if you were listening yesterday. I was trying to muddle my way through it. For those that don't know, Buick Envision is some sort of a joint venture between Buick and an outfit in China, and they make them over there. Now, when I say make them over there, they assemble them over there. I don't know where the transmissions are made. I don't know where the motors are made, but I did read this article about you're crazy if you think you're going to stop all these tariffs by tariffs. They said any car here, all these the cars now that have become, you know, it's not like buying a 98 Chevy pickup with roll down windows and stuff, because all the drivers, all the little motors, all the stuff that run the seats and the tailgate and all this kind of crap and all these sensors, all that stuff. Not all of it, but a large part of that. These little motors and little thingies, they're all made overseas. Taiwan, China, Vietnam, someplace. To source that stuff, most people don't know where it's coming from. I mean, obviously GM does and Ford does. But anyway, they put this, first of all, they're assembling it over there. Now, last I checked, Kevin, and we talked about it, to assemble a car is what? Somewhere between 18 and 30 hours? Okay, so even if we're paying $50 here or $100, and we're paying 10 over there, well, okay, you save $90 times 25. You're saving $2,000 in a car. Well, it costs $2,500 to ship it over here. So I don't know how you even break even on that. Plus, this whole thing, I can't put together any numbers here that make sense. And also, the tariffs in Mexico, BMW evidently has a plant in Mexico, so we're affecting them, and somebody else is down there. If it's Mercedes or Honda or somebody. These are foreign companies assembling cars in Mexico for sale, I guess, in Mexico and here. So, but I, at the end of the day, I'm saying, okay, now this Buick, whatever this thing is, now if they ban it getting here, well, that's one thing. But if they don't, it's now going to be $50,000, right? Unless Buick cuts part of it down and all that kind of crap. But say it's $50,000. Well, now the people here might just say, hey, screw those guys. You know, if you're a Trumper or whatever, you might say, screw those guys. I'm going to go out there and buy this other car for $35 that's made here, and I'm money ahead. Well, wait a minute. That's not how it works. The place here might say, well, now my competitor is now $50,000. They used to be $40,000, and I was $38,000. Guess what? I can slide up to $43,000 now and get away with it. I mean, that happens. It's a vibrant market. At the end of the day, my best guess, Kevin, is the average price of a car here is going to go up between $5,000 and $12,000. In a market that I see is already priced out some huge percentage of your population, and I see used prices going up almost every day. And I see everybody who has a car repair facility, the cars are parked out to the street because people are doing the best they can to keep the old junks running. And I don't know, from a political standpoint, I don't know what you're gaining. And I do think, you know, if I was a big Trump supporter, I'd say, wait a minute, most of those people, who's to say why people voted for anybody, but most of those people voted for you because, not most, some, because you are going to bring back this inflation. Not only going forward, but going back. Some people believed that part or read into that part of the campaign. You're not addressing that. You're going the other way. Or what am I missing?
Well, there will be other forces that are, you know, that would counter the idea of raising prices on domestically produced cars. I do expect them to go up because they can. But on the other hand, if your strategy was to increase your market share, then you would take advantage of that opportunity to sell while you can. You know, while you have a competitive price advantage. And of course, the longer term strategy is, well, we'll produce more cars domestically, and as a result of that, that'll give downward pressure on the prices because they won't be subject to tariffs. They will be able to compete with those who've raised prices. I don't know how it's going to shake out. I think there's just going to be a lot of economic forces that come into play there that are going to push and pull on prices. I imagine that push will win for the most part. But but I don't think it's quite as easy as saying if you're going to tear off another car $10,000, then everybody else is going to raise their price by five. I think there's a lot, and
well, you think they're going to raise their plus if you take the complexity of car purchases in the first place, a lot of times people buy cars 10, 15, 20% under list price. Well, the people here may not raise their list price at all because all of a sudden they don't come off as much. I mean, it's such a complex. I'm trying to figure out not just how, if I can figure it out, whether the Trump administration can figure out whether they're gaining or losing on the deal. One thing I do know, Kevin, and this is, if the total take of car tariffs is $50 billion, whatever the hell the number comes out to be, it's coming out of somebody's pocket here. That part I know.
it is. And, you know, Carl put in chat that he can speak to that, and because he knows a lot of people in collision and maintenance, and they know what's going to happen. So, you know, I'll defer to that. You guys can talk about that, because I think, you know, that'll be a different perspective, too. I just don't think it's not the simplest math equation going.
It's very complicated.
Conceptually, it is, but in terms of what other forces would come into play, I would say that if I were a domestic producer and I really, really wanted to increase my market share, and I don't even know I'd have to go look it up and see what's the market share spread in the United States for different brands of cars. I don't know if Toyota's number one, if GM's number one, if, you know, I think
Toyota used to be. I
couldn't tell you, but I would tell you that if Hyundai is producing cars in the United States, they might say, this is a chance for us to seize the moment and take some share away from anybody else who wants to raise their prices. Because they've always been about, you know, trying to penetrate markets.
Well, but if it comes down to, again, the reason why I harp on this too much is because I remember vividly my exam at the University of Chicago, I forget what course it was, regarding tariffs, and, you know, take this all the way through from start to finish, who got to do what, and how can you figure out who's getting what where, and start out with one car. Start out with a Mercedes coming here fully assembled. And I'll tell you what, I sweated over this thing for 2.5 hours, trying to figure out who's doing what where, how big, what Cadillac's motivation would be, you know, what the demand, if there was a high demand for those high-cost cars in the first place, or if there wasn't. It's amazingly complicated for one car fully assembled. Now, I mean, what if all the transmissions and engines are made here, and they go to China, they ship them over there in the first place? Now, is China going to put a tariff on the engine that goes into the car that comes back here with a tariff? I mean, I don't even know. Has anybody thought through this?
I am sure that there are people on that economic team that know exactly how it works.
Your lips to God's ears, buddy. I'm telling you, it's pretty complicated. I was pretty smart about this stuff. What was it? Cry havoc and let loose the dogs of war? Was that and see where it all lands? Who was that? Was that Shakespeare? Well, or was that Plato?
I need to look up the Commerce Secretary's name because it's not rolling off of my C-R-E-T-A-R-1.
Well, he was the guy who was telling everybody to buy Teslas. Lutnick,
yeah.
He was the guy who was Lutnick, telling everybody to buy Teslas the other day. He was hyping Teslas. Just saying. How come, why don't we buy this Rivian, the guys who make the electric trucks, and put a regular motor in there? That's a beautiful truck. Who the hell wants an electric truck, though?
Not me.
No. But the thing's gorgeous. Anyway, so what do you got going this weekend? Anything good? It's supposed to be nice weather.
I don't know. I got class in the morning. I'm in French Lick right now, so it's, you know, attend some all morning sessions and then head home. And so I'll get home sometime tonight. I got a prep class for the morning. Irish women play at 1:00, I think, and then I'll probably take a nap after that.
God. Well, you're gonna go see Larry Bird. Did he move back there? Or where does he live?
I have no idea where Larry Bird lives now, but we've talked about this before in the past. There's a raging argument between Hanover and and French Lick about which one is the doofus capital of Indiana.
Oh, good. Tell you what,
that's from Cheers. That's a Cheers skit.
We vacationed down there when I was very young. It was really deep south. Deep south.
It's not that anymore.
No. Anyway, bud.
It's deep Hoosier, but it's not deep south.
It's a long drive. It's way past Indianapolis, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm closer to Evansville than I am, you know, and I'm past Bloomington, you know, well on the way to Evansville, so... It's going to be a good 5 to 5.5, you know, and being an old man, I'm going to have to get out and stretch my legs a time or two.
Why doesn't a guy like you have a Maybach with a driver?
Because I'm a guy like me.
You should have a driver. You could do all the work on the way down there. One of those Mercedes limos. You'd be cool with that.
Yeah, well, I was up doing work this morning instead.
Oh, God. All right, but take care of yourself. SP Futures down 5, NASDAQ Futures down 42. Why don't we take like a 30-second break. I'll come back because we missed our other one, and we'll be with Carl.
How much confidence do you have that your investments will make you wealthy? Do you truly know the odds? Welcome to Luckbox, the control freak's guide to life, money, and probability. Luckbox shows you how to factor in the likelihood of success before you commit to an investment or any other life decision. Your brain is smarter than your gut, and that's why you owe it to yourself to read Luckbox. We've made it easy because Luckbox is free for 1 year at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Each new issue dives deep into the current investing climate, separates the signal from the noise with timely, actionable trading ideas and equips you with savvy investing tactics you don't already know, all while exploring how to live your best life through music, spirits, food, sports, travel, fitness, and a whole lot more. Luckbox is the essential magazine for proactive investors who are hell-bent on controlling their financial futures. It's for overachievers and alpha types who don't buy into Wall Street's investment gurus. It's for mavericks who believe in life, luxury, and the pursuit of happiness. It's for you. Smart investors don't bet on possibilities, they play the probabilities. Luckbox is $7.99 on newsstands, but you can subscribe for 10 free digital issues at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Don't rely on luck. Get Luckbox at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks.
Stocks, jocks,
stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hear ye, hear ye. The Homer Broadcasting System is on the air.
Money. Well, we'll pick stocks and jocks. I'm Tomo. Ricky Garcia on the board. SP Futures down 4. NASDAQ Futures down 37. Yesterday was an odd day. We were Donald in the morning, and we shot up. Boy, you had to be quick as a bunny rabbit to sell anything when it was up, because then it turned right back down again. It was a kind of a bizarre day. We had Lululemon's earnings came out, and yet another one here. Questioned Carl about this. Straddle was $32, and the stock's down 40. So we blew through the straddle like yet again. Stock's trading 302, so it's down whatever that is, 8-10%. That's a lot. Continuing strength in the metals, gold and silver, you know, almost way past where I thought they would go. So we, I have to be in full disclosure, the year has been pretty, you know, not so hot for most investors, but for my people who last couple of years really wanted to, a lot of them wanted to be in the gold and the gold miners because they didn't want to chase some of the other stocks. So we have a big position in there, and we've had, God, we got to be, you know, things up 30% in 3 months this year. I mean, I don't know if we've made all the 30, but still, it's our guys are cheering this whole thing. It's up again today. Carl, do you think there's any? I mean, for a long time, even though you know the dollars were flowing in the system and the euro dollars and everything else, and yet gold really didn't participate like you would have expected it to. You know, it was like Bitcoin was the new gold. Is there something? Should we be worried about, not worried about, but is there something now that people are not thinking that Bitcoin's a big store of value? It's still up. I mean, it's not like it's down or anything, but it really has not progressed this year like gold has. Is there some sort of change in tone here or something?
Well, I certainly hope so.
Well, I do too, but I you know.
I get it. We have these kinds of things going on in the trading side of my forum all time, right? I mean, there's people that were in Bitcoin, you know, 10, 15 years ago, and of course, you know, they're multimillionaires started out with very little money.
Have any of them sold it?
Well, this is the problem, right?
Yeah.
All right, is that, yeah, you know, and I've I'm trying to teach my daughter this stuff too, to some extent, because you know she's got a very small account, but it's, you know, it's her money, and it's all after tax stuff. It's taxable. So, but you know, she's like, you know, little position, and then you know we have the kind of days that we've had the last couple of weeks, and she's like, Dad, it went way, you know, this went way up, now then it went way down, now I want that money back. And I'm like, you know, this is why I said, if you are not, you know, if you don't have a stomach for this kind of thing, you sit in a money market and you take your 4% or 4.5% or whatever it is, and you just shut up. Because that is what happens in equities, and it doesn't matter where you are, and you have to understand that if you're going to do that kind of thing and you have sort of a stomach for it, you put on a hedge, and I can show you how to do that. And hedges are just like car insurance. You expect to lose them, but they prevent you from getting cremated when things run.
No. See, you're missing the point. If you buy puts on your stack to protect it, and the stack goes up, you wasted your money, and your broker was an idiot.
Well, you know, you have a concern about something in the relatively short term, so you put on a small inverse position, right?
Yep.
Because you don't have options capability. And you expect that inverse position, it's a hedge. You do not expect it to gain money. But if it does, it's because it protected you from getting cremated on something else, right?
Well, that's right.
Yeah. To some extent. I mean, you know, it's like anything else. Hedges have value in some circumstances. You can blow through them. But even when that happens, it will blunt the pain. It may not take it all, but it will blunt some of it. And that's, that's their purpose. And so, I mean, if you want to use them for speculation, that's a different thing. Then you're willing to lose the money.
Well, you have to, when you do this, we won't spend long on this, but it gets pretty technical. What is your hedge?
Exactly. You have to be careful that what you think you're hedging is actually what you're hedging.
I mean, you could say, for instance, if you really didn't like if you were long all the Magnificent Seven,
right,
and been long every one of those forever, you maybe could get away with like buying puts on the QQQ, because
right.
Because the QQQ is 50%.
It's mostly
50%, 55 somewhere in there.
Well, it's enough that it matters.
It's enough that it matters, but it still doesn't protect you from Meta having some sort of problem, being down 40%, and the Qs are down 2%.
Right. So you have to be very careful with what are you actually protecting versus what do you think you're protecting? Because if you get that one wrong, then you're going to get the possibility of getting a really bad surprise is still there, right? So, I mean, this is kind of the art of it, right? But the thing is, what I think is so interesting is that when you look at where multiples are right now, what people are paying for things, okay, in the markets, whether it's houses, whether it's, whatever. Houses, obviously, different, it's a different market, but it's still an asset, right, like anything else. I look at Bitcoin, for example, and my argument all along has been, look, it's not they call it cryptocurrency. The first thing, if you're analyzing something, is you have to call things by what they actually are.
Oh, that's no fun. That's no fun.
Well, I understand that. But a currency has to be both a medium of exchange and a store of value. Okay, that is the definition of a currency. It has to have both functions. And Bitcoin has never done either of them
no.
well.
No, it became an artificial stock somehow.
It essentially is a stock.
Yeah.
Okay, now nobody wants to think of it as a stock, and yet it's not even a stock in many ways. I think Bitcoin is better thought of as a derivative.
Well, what's the difference between a company that has zero earnings, not much, trading for 100 times revenue and 200 times earnings, You might, if you take it a little bit further, you got a company that doesn't do anything, Bitcoin.
Well, how about MSTR?
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying, right? Well,
wait,
you see the other guys yesterday? Now we're going to put all their cash in Bitcoin. Who are they getting? CrowdStrike?
GameStop.
GameStop, yeah. What is that?
Yeah, that's another. Well, you know, but here's, okay, so there's a company, you know, that got caught up in the whole meme thing, right? And you know, this is a firm that used to have, years and years ago, a solid but not fancy business, right? They sold games and consoles that people had bought and then were tired of. Right, so they basically became like a goodwill store for, you know, for gamers. Right?
So they were bricks and mortar though, right?
Yeah. They had stores all over. There was one right near the Walmart where I used to live in Florida, and my kid, you know, at the time she was, you know, she liked video games. She had, you know, she had all the common consoles and things like, and, you know, she'd buy the new one she wanted, you know, when she was younger, you know, that would be on the Christmas list, right? What she wanted for Christmas this year was, you know, the new PlayStation, because the old one, she'd played all those games, she'd finished them, she was bored with that, she wanted something new. Well, guess what? You can sit on those as a collection, or you could take them over to GameStop, sell them back to GameStop, right, for a fraction of their original price, and then GameStop would turn around, put a markup on them, and sell them as used stuff. A unexciting but legitimate business. And you had plenty of people that are like, well, you know, I want to play, you know, Grand Theft Auto, whatever, but I don't own the console yet. Well, you know, gee, I don't want to pay, you know, for last year's, you know, 2 years ago console plus the, you know. Okay, but at you know, 30% of what they cost new, it's not a bad, you know, okay, right? So, I mean, this was their business model. But then the game manufacturers essentially torpedoed that, because now everything's downloaded. So physical media went away. And as physical media went away, their business was essentially destroyed. Okay, it's much like what happened with dial-up internet service, and that, you know, all right, now we've got cable modems. Oops, I can't compete in that because I don't have access to the rights of way. So even if I have the money to pull, you know, fiber or whatever to people's houses, I can't, because I can't get access. All right, so I'm locked out by a monopoly position, and I better find some other way to make money doing internet related things, or I'm screwed as my customer base slowly goes to zero. Well, the same thing happened to GameStop. So, you know, I mean, it wasn't their fault. It wasn't that they were poorly run. It's just that the market changed out from under them. It happens to companies all the time. And the thing that I think is so fascinating is that Bitcoin has continued to be seen as this nebulous thing, when, as far as I'm concerned, it's much like a futures contract, that, you know, a continuous futures contract doesn't roll, right?
Yeah, pretty much.
And has the sort of volatility from a margin perspective, as, for example, trading spoofs.
Well, you know, Kevin and I were talking, you know, maybe too long about sports and who the customer is and why people care about their universities and those kinds of things, or maybe people don't care. And you look at I find the phenomenon right now, because, you know, we still, even though we have, you know, pretty much plenty, you know, we'd still take a few more customers. I mean, we're pretty selective, but we'd take a few more customers. You know, there's people that don't want us. There's people where I don't want you. It's not that often, but
it happens.
The phenomenon that I'm seeing, and maybe it's always kind of been there, Carl, is people have had this run up in some of this stuff, these stocks that they love, and you develop. I mean, Apple is not a stock anymore; it's a religion.
Right. Well, you marry them.
Yeah. You can't. They don't care about you. You can't care about them. And Apple does pay a dividend, but so many stocks that don't pay a dividend. I mean, I just talk to people and say, okay, you were lucky. You bought 5,000 shares of XYZ 20 years ago, and it's done nothing but go up. They still are not going to send you a check ever. Which is fine. You know that going in. So it's not like they're bad people or anything like that. But now it's incumbent upon you to peel a little off as time goes by. They're not sending you the dividend, so the stock price goes up. Well, then you should be selling, you know, 50 shares a year or something to get your piece going forward. I mean, it's not that you should or shouldn't, depending on your situation, but the fact is you need to essentially take your own money off the table here. They're not going to do it for you.
It's one of the things. I mean, there's two things that I have observed, all the way back to the 1990s. I don't trade nearly as actively today as I used to, primarily because I don't want to stick my nose in the damn computer all day long. But one of the things that I have observed is that nobody does that. Nobody will do that.
No.
It is, and oh, by the way, the other thing that they'll do is they'll take a position that's a winner, they'll sit on it, it will turn into, something will go wrong, and they will double into it because it's got to come back.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
No, it doesn't. And you can end up with enormous wipeouts that way. That's one of those, double it, adding into a loser once maybe, but you see people that do it repeatedly, time after time after time, and oh my God, is that a good way to wipe out your trading account? So, I mean, there's all sorts of stuff like this. I mean, yeah, I tell a story all the time about, during the crash, I shorted naked a whole crap ton of GE puts. Okay, and it was a large enough trade that I got a call from the brokerage. They're like,
well, yeah.
"Do you have any idea what you're doing here?" And I, absolutely. Well, can you describe?
Well, because most people have no idea.
Well, and they, do you know what you're doing here? I mean, I had the money to clear it if I got assigned, and I said, "Yeah, I don't believe this company's going out of business, but I am." First off, the premium was very nice. Thank you very much. Secondly, if I get assigned, I want to get assigned.
This had to be a while ago because GE almost did go out of business.
Well, no, it was during that period of time when people thought they might.
Yeah.
Okay, and I sold $5 puts. And I'm like, okay, my maximum risk on this trade, if I get assigned, is $5, right? Because it can go to zero. All right. On the other hand, if I get put, I don't have to time the exact moment of the trade. As long as it doesn't go to zero and the company survives, and that's what I believe is going to happen. This could be an extraordinarily profitable trade because I get it at five and it runs back up to 15 or 20 or whatever. And as it turns out, I didn't get assigned, so I just kept the premium. But I was trying to get assigned because I wanted to put this thing on and then be able to walk away from it up until expiration. Well, it never hit.
Well, you'd rather not get assigned, just keep your cash.
Well, I was happy either way. Okay, and from the premium, I had obviously that meant that my basis was going to be under $5 because I got the premium. Right?
One of my best buddies is mom. I think it's still alive somewhere, but she one of the old time moms. You know what I'm talking about. Just a character. What a great lady. And this is a few years ago, and this is when Citigroup first started going down like a rock.
Oh yeah.
And this is what? Was this 2007? Yeah, must have been there.
Now, see, they were that one was too dangerous. I wasn't going to play that game.
Well, he was trading for, and she had an account with us, or still does, I think. And he was trading her stuff here. So, I go to this party. She goes, "Hey, Tommy, come out over here." Jimmy says he bought this Citigroup, and he liked to trade in and out, and all of a sudden I see this stock in there, and it's down. He tells me, "It's a long-term investment. Does that mean it's a crappy trade?" And I go, "Yeah." It's exactly. Well, that means it's a crappy trade, right? And I go, "Yeah."
Yeah, pretty much.
She had it all figured out. So you want to talk a little bit about, I cannot figure out.
I want to talk about this car thing a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I don't. At the end of the day, you're collecting money, and I think here, my guess is it's going to be $8,000 to $10,000 a car, maybe 5 to 10, and the government's going to have a whole bunch of dough.
But not for long. Okay, so here's the challenge. What's going to happen is it's going to produce shifts in the market, and that will happen quite rapidly. Now this assumes that this is one of the problems I have with Trump. Okay, Trump likes to threaten things, shoot his mouth off, and then all of a sudden it goes away. Right, or gets modified or whatever have you. And one of the biggest issues I have with people like him is that if you're serious about doing something to someone, whatever that something is, you don't threaten it. You just do it. No warning. Bang. If I've got pictures of you diddling a little boy, all right, I don't tell anybody I got pictures of you diddling a little boy, because then you could hire somebody to assassinate me, right?
Yeah.
I don't do that.
He might find somebody for cheap for you.
Well, but yeah, I mean, you know, maybe it's only a couple hundred bucks, right, to run me over with a truck in the parking lot today. But that's if I'm serious about rocking your world, I don't do that. All right, if I'm serious about rocking your world and I'm not trying to extort you, I want to ruin you. I just release it. I just dump them out everywhere on the internet at once, and you're screwed. All right, because you can't react to it. You can't do anything preemptively. Now you have to deal with whatever it is. So my problem with where Trump is coming from with a lot of these policy things and things like this, and this extends to many areas, is that he puts the announcements up, and he's like, well, on this day I'm going to, no. This tells me right there, you know, so-called 4D chess man is, you know, he's playing checkers. Okay, maybe he's playing tic-tac-toe, but he's certainly not playing chess, because I have done plenty of bare-knuckle business negotiating, and I never gave anybody warning what was coming. If I had a strategic plan set out that I was going to use to ram one of my competitors or a supplier or whatever it was, they just got it in the face.
Well, it's a style, Carl, and it's never been my style.
I get that, but the thing is that the problem I have with this is that the difference between competition and extortion is that style, okay? And I'm not interested in playing. I'm very interested in competing.
He'd be a guy that if you had your house for sale for $500,000, he'd come in with two big gunsels behind him and starts telling you that he wants your house, that price is absurd. By the way, do you like your dog? He knows where your daughter goes to school.
Well, that's.
And then when he walks out, the guy's going to say he really means he's 475 bid. Well, that's not my style, and it never will be. You know.
Well, like I said, Chief, that's the difference between bare knuckle business and extortion. Okay, because the second one is that's what the second, you know, what you're talking about essentially is. I don't play that game. All right, if I'm going to screw you, I'm just going to screw you. There isn't going to be a discussion in advance, and there's going to be here it is. You know, hope you had your titanium plate on this morning on the back, because if not, so, and here's the thing is this: if you're going to have any kind of consistency, you're going to actually get anything done when it comes to the government, when it comes to business, whatever have you. I have long advocated we need to deal with this tariff, this whole tariff and exploitation issue.
When you talk about tariffs, you're talking a totally different ballgame. You're talking about something that makes some sense, tries to even up the pollution, tries to even up. If I could summarize
wage
your stuff,
and environmental parity.
Well, but if I could summarize your views, which by the way I happen to agree with, I don't know how you do it, but is if you got the Rio Grande and you got anti-pollution laws on your side of the Rio Grande, that somebody can go across the river and pour it in from the other side and it's okay. But you're saying you got to even that up. And I don't think anybody would necessarily disagree with that. How you do that probably would be a pretty good exercise for somebody. But I'm saying, the more I dig into what he's doing, I can't figure it out.
Well, this is, here's the basic issue. So you have companies' vehicles that, although they appear to not be American, are more American than American vehicles. In terms of content.
Right.
Okay? You have the kind of crazy stuff that I have uncovered digging around a little bit in the supply chain things, because, you know, when Trump was elected, this was one of the things he was, you know, this tariff thing in the automobiles and first term he redid NAFTA into something that supposedly was better. Well, actually, it wasn't any better. It was just different. It was supposed to solve the problem, didn't actually solve anything. And so I started looking at this, and I found, like, this example that I've cited a couple of times in the show. You have a plant that takes a piece of steel, you know, off a coil, stamps a part, ships it across the Ambassador Bridge. Something, parts get added to that. It gets shipped back across the Ambassador Bridge and ends up going into an assembly plant. And I look at this and I say, this is an illogical flow of material. It is additional items of expense because the Ambassador Bridge is not free to cross, and neither is the truck. And so, you've got the load and unload and everything else, right? So I got all these different things that go back and forth, and I'm like, the logical business person would stick a plant halfway between the assembly plant and the stamping plant, and that's where that step would take place. Or he'd buy the land next to the stamping plant. Yeah. Right? And now that they could go on a conveyor belt.
But all this stuff is a 2 or 3 year project.
Well, I get that. Yeah. Okay, but the thing is that these facts on the ground tell me that there's an arbitrage play in the middle somewhere that I don't see and I don't understand, but I know it's there because economically what they're doing doesn't make any sense otherwise. So there is an arbitrage play. And to the extent that you take those out of the system and you force that stuff back in the United States, that is a net positive. And the problem from the standpoint of the manufacturer is that you're not seeing that arbitrage benefit as a customer in lower prices. What they're getting is that arbitrage benefit in a higher multiple. All right. So that makes the K, if you will, the K-shaped economy that we have today, that makes the legs of the K wider. The people on the bottom get screwed harder and the people on the top get more money. So if you do this in a way that pulls both of those legs in, so now the people at the top get hammered, you see a massive change in multiples and repricing in asset markets. But at the same time, you add demand for labor in America, legal labor in America, and you destroy some of the demand for goods and services in America by getting rid of the illegals. You pull the bottom leg of the K up and the top leg of the K down. This isn't going to make people very happy who own stocks, but what it is going to do is make the general balance in the economy better.
Yeah, but if you do it in such a half-assed random way, nobody's going to commit to doing anything here.
Well, not only, yeah, there's that problem. The second thing is, you've got, so another example, and one place where it's being done correctly is this endangerment finding from the EPA on carbon dioxide. Now that is being reversed, but it's being done through the proper formal process. For once, thank God, the Trump administration doing this the right way instead of the wrong way, which is by some kind of EO, right? And the other thing is it's backed up by the Supreme Court's decision with the Chevron deference, which is going to make it very, very hard for a subsequent administration because, he's going to be out of office in 3.5 years, right? I mean, I don't know.
Or sooner.
but it won't be him, yeah. Okay, in 3.5 years. The thing is, it will be extremely difficult for any administration that follows to reverse that. It is not going to be easy. All right, so now why does this matter? Because the modern internal combustion vehicle today, your SUV is $90,000, right? Why is it $90,000? Because it has, I can use the S word on this
yep.
show, right? Okay. It has been enshittified. The driveline has been enshittified. You have active fuel management. You have cylinder deactivation. You have shaving of margins internally, pressure and load and everything, and the 10-speed transmissions. All these things have destroyed the reliability of modern drivelines. Now, there are people who say this was a conspiracy to drive people into electric vehicles. I don't know if it is or isn't. What I do know is that I have two vehicles that I care for, one mine, one my daughter's, that are at or near 300,000 miles on the road. One of them is old enough to drink. The other one's my Mazda. Neither of them has had a single internal component in the driveline touched since it was built. Now, you today would be hard-pressed to buy anything new today
that would return that kind of service life.
Oh, without a doubt.
All right. Guess what? If this endangerment finding is reversed, and then one of these manufacturers goes and says, all right, we're going to build 5.3 liter V8s or 6.2 liter V8s. We're going to go back to the reliable lifter designs that don't have all this extra crap on them. We're going to get that. We're going to get rid of this variable speed oil pump because that thing was good for another four thousandths of a mile per gallon. Okay, but it starved the engine of lubrication once a little bit of wear went on. By the way, this is why the 6.2 GMs are chucking rods through the block. Okay.
Yeah.
We're going to take that stuff and we're going to bin it. We've known how to build reliable internal combustion gasoline engines for more than 20 years that will go 200,000 to 300,000 miles a day by touching them. And we're also going to get rid of these 10-speed automatics that have just too much crap piled into too small a box. We'll go back to the 6 speeds. Yes, this will cost half a mile a gallon when we do these things. And we'll let you, if you don't want all these electronic garbage things that are in there, that, you know, $3,000 for a set of sensor, for a sensor recalibration, make, you know, your windshield all of a sudden is a $1,000 job if it gets broken by a rock instead of $200. This, by the way, drives a lot of insurance costs.
Your thing is breaking up here.
I'm sorry.
Why don't we go to break and we come back and everything will be all fixed. And I'm reading here about the tariffs and stuff from Mexico. What is it? And as you know, I'm not a big fan of the new administration. I think, I don't know. Part of it is just this is style points, but everybody, all these guys are. If I was the head of commerce or something, and I'm there for 6 weeks or 8 weeks, my nose would be in a report all day long. These guys don't even. They're out campaigning. They're out doing.
Now, Chief Lutnick and Leitzinger, I listened to a couple of interviews from these guys, they get it.
I don't. You know what? I don't. You're kind of coming at me like Kevin. Just because somebody can get on a softball interview thing, and I can make anybody sound smart if I want to, and I'm not near as good an interview as those.
But I'm not talking about a softball. I'm talking about like hour long podcast level free form.
I know, but I'm saying is
shut up and let you say what you want to say.
I know, but my point is. They're very articulate. They're very good at what they do. I mean, have you ever read a?
By the way, how do you think Cantor got to be what it is? Do you think it was because the people that run the place are stupid?
I think there's a Peter principle everywhere, and I don't know this guy that much. I mean, I know that a boatload of their guys got killed 9/11.
Yeah, they did, and guess what? The one thing that did push my buttons is that he seems to think the government owns all the land that isn't privately held by somebody and actually has ownership rights to it as opposed to being a conservator. You want to talk about stuff that makes a hair stand up.
Oh, yeah. I'm saying
that did it for me.
I don't anyway, we got a break, but I don't think I really know. I did something really awful. I read the book called A Man Called Intrepid. Did you ever read that?
No, I have not read that one.
Pretty interesting. Boy, talk about a guy that you would love. The guy who was the head of British Secret Service during the war, a guy named Bill Stevenson. It was about his life and how he ran the British Secret Service. Get a load of this. The guy was a brilliant mathematician, evidently. Was one of the co-inventors of television.
Cool.
And did like some other stuff. And oh, by the way, was a light heavyweight boxing champ for a while.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, and then they said during the war, he didn't run around talking to people. He's basically M from the Bond movies.
Right, right. Gotcha.
And so the guy every day would read the equivalent of a Victorian novel in reports.
Yeah.
And these are the kind of people and mentality. I mean, what did Churchill read all day? I mean, same way with Roosevelt. These are the kind of people I compare everybody. You know, like I said, I'm not a massive fan of Trump, but I'm the first person to say the man has an incredible skill set.
Right.
These people all have a skill set. Now the guy in the Commerce Department has an amazing skill set. I'm sure he does, or he wouldn't have become the head of Canada, where he came from. The question is it the skill set I want? Is it the skill set that he's going to drop everything else and become the best Commerce Secretary, or is all his other crap on the table? I mean, is it about his company? Is it about all the other stuff?
I think you're right. I mean, there's, although I'll tell you what, if you take a look at where these policies are coming from, the guys that supposedly are just just in it to try to turn their $3 billion into $5 billion, it ain't gonna work out so good.
Well, I mean, would you ever compare Trump to Harry Truman in terms of his own stuff?
Oh, good God, no!
No, we're not even on that page.
No, we're not. You're not even in the. But you know what? We don't live in a world where you can be that and actually get the office anymore.
Well, that's the point. I mean, something I've mentioned since before the show started. I said we're in an age where people somewhat have to come to grip, or not, that the skill set you need to get one of these offices is probably not the skill set you want in the office.
It's the world has changed, and I can't unchange it.
Well, it's been in human relations your whole time.
Well, I mean,
if a girl's looking for a guy, and she wants to lead her to pack, but I mean she wants to be what did the lady on Star Trek say? I was a captain's woman before. I'll be a captain's woman again. Okay, but that doesn't mean the guy's going to be tender. Right, or the guy's gonna find the best looking girl he can find. Doesn't mean she's a good wife or a good person, does it?
Well, and by the way, 5 years from now that's gonna change.
SP futures down 18, NASDAQ futures down 96. Be right back, Stocks and Jocks.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Howell. You're Ricky on the board. S&P futures are down 22. NASDAQ futures down 110. Also, Ricky, don't let me forget to ask Carl what his view of how the young people are defining recession these days, because I mean, we certainly talk about it on the show, and the way they manipulate the numbers, you can't probably do the old way. That's probably more of an aggressive statement than maybe needs to be. But anyway, over in Asia, we've got the Asia markets fall as Trump tariff threats weigh. Thailand suspends trading after earthquake. I didn't spot that one. Nikkei down 679. That's a number. 1.8%. Hang Seng down 152.6%. Shanghai finally is moving. Down 22.7%. It's been like unchanged the last couple days. Over in Europe, we've got the DAX down 129.6%. FTSE's up. FTSE's been going the opposite way. The other two guys kind of for a while. FTSE up 14.2%, CAC around down 44.6. Bonds down 5 basis points, 4.31. The Bund down 4 basis points, 2.72. As a way of review on yesterday, after being up, down, up, down, we ended up down 18 in the S&P, down 94 in the NASDAQ. Like I said, you had a chance to sell the NASDAQ up 100 yesterday, but you had to have your bullets in the gun for sure to do that. Oil up 11 cents, over 70, 70.03. It's been creeping back all week, finally made it over 70. Ran up 11 cents, 74.14. Gold up again today, another $19, 31.10. Silver up 27 cents, 35.36. Crypto down 2,300 bucks, 84,894. Pretty Air Force traffic, weather, sports. A lot of sports. Cubs win. Sox win.
Morning, Chief. It's currently 7:39 a.m. here in Chicago. 51 degrees right now with a high of 75. Becoming windier and warmer. Cloudy and a couple of showers early this morning, but then it comes sunny this afternoon. Tonight will be mainly clear, windy, and mild with a low of 60 degrees. Phoenix, Arizona, 70 degrees right now with a high of 82. Not as warm with intervals of clouds and sun. Tonight partly cloudy with a low of 59 degrees. Traffic in Chicago is looking pretty nice today. Iman Kennedy from Monroe's 18 minutes. Iman Innes from Lane Cook, 32 minutes. We're looking at 20 minutes. Iman Eisenhower from Wolf. Iman Dan Ryan from 95th, 16 minutes. And Stevenson from 294 to the Dan Ryan, 16 minutes. Bulls beat Lakers yesterday, 119 to 117. Tonight we got the Golden Knights here at Blackhawks, 7:30 p.m. And yesterday we got White Sox beating Angels 8-1 and Cubs beating Diamondbacks 10-6. Today we got another game, Cubs at Diamondbacks, 8:40 p.m. Back over to you guys.
I think that all the Blackhawks guys have a calendar. They're Xing out the days.
Man, I don't know.
This season's over. This is pretty bad.
Yeah.
Anyway, Carl, I got a. What did you think of what we were talking about earlier? If you saw it about, since our Fed is going to come out with their PC today, which is the biggest line of crap ever.
Oh my God!
I mean, so they will never admit. What we didn't even did we even admit to recession during COVID?
Well, you know, no. But here's the thing that I always find rather astonishing about this. Okay, I mean, you know, the formal. Well, first off, the Fed doesn't do that. Okay, it's the Conference Board, right? That officially defines it.
Well, who does the? What's the difference between the PCE and the GDP deflator? I mean, who does the deflator?
Well, the deflator is part of the calculation done by the.
To not lose everybody here. Sorry to interrupt, Carly. To not lose everybody when your GDP comes out, and which was the total of all goods and services in the country. It used to be gross national product, then it became gross domestic product. I'm not exactly sure the difference there, Carl. But anyway,
the difference is where it's produced.
Okay, but let's not go into that. We'll do that next week. But the GDP is the total goods of all goods and services done in the country. All right, so whatever it is, you got a haircut, it's $40. It's in there. You buy something for $40, it's in there. That's the idea. But if all of a sudden everything's 10% higher from last year, they say, okay, there's been inflation of 10%. What's the real GDP growth? We want to. So there's three numbers here. There's the gross number, the nominal number, shall we say? Then somebody says, yeah, but your inflation was 10%, so
you take that out.
Yeah, you grew 10%, so you're actually flat. But that number is called the GDP deflator. Now you got the CPI, which the Labor Statistics Bureau of Labor Statistics does, right? They've got the PCE. We're not sure who that does. They do, I mean, because they won't tell you any of the details.
We don't know how they do that.
We don't know how or who. And what, you can't go down the list like you can in the CPI. Then there's this deflator. I'm not sure exactly who does that, but that. So if they come out like GDP day and they say the GDP is growth is 2.5%, which means it was up 4 and our deflator was 1.5. The growth minus their inflation rate is a net of 2.5 of real growth.
Correct.
So if you, for instance, I don't know if you'd agree with me, Carl, but I think if you were to go back and say you were using the CPI, which is one we can actually look at, if you went back to 2000 and you would have taken the healthcare piece from 6.5% of people's basket to somewhere between 18 and 20, which is a part of the GDP, I'm going to say that we've been in a recession 80% of those years for most people.
Yes, and well, and there's another problem with this too, which is that if you think about what that ought to mean, okay, it should mean that in real terms, in other words, inflation-adjusted terms, as defined by the goods and services that real people have to buy, right? In other words, how much money is left after you make your money, right? In real terms, asset prices should be flat by that, okay? X productivity. So the only way you should be able to actually improve an asset return beyond that, beyond whatever that numerical ratio is by making things better, faster, cheaper.
Right, by innovation.
I mean, that's
which gives you a head start on somebody else.
Well, productivity is simply doing more with less.
But even if in a world of, say, no patents or anything, and we're talking about that today, but even in a world of no patents, if you're the first out with the hula hoop, going back, show my age, and there's no such thing as a patent on a hula hoop. You just put it out there. If somebody goes, holy creep, bleep, Batman, this guy's got a hula hoop out there and they're selling for $5 a piece. I think this slimy Carl's only cost them 50 cents to make one. Okay, right. So I'm going to run out and I'm going to get a piece of property. I'm going to build a factory.
I'm going to start making them.
But I still get 6 months or a year head start.
Right.
And if I'm real clever, I won't charge $5. I'll charge maybe $2, where somebody says, this Carl's doing pretty good, but not really enough for me to go in there and try and mess with him.
Right.
So there's an advantage to being first, but at the end of the day, when everything all equalizes, you should be almost be back to somewhat of a risk-free rate, right? There shouldn't be...
The arbitrage should not work over any length of time.
Well, also, I mean, this is... Boy, you know, I'd have to have you on the air. Maybe next Friday we'll talk about it a bit. I could make a case if I could clone and go back to maybe where I used to be able to write pretty good. I could make a case that over a period of time, other than normal, maybe a little bit of inflation, the owner of the building should not make any greater return than the guy who rents from him.
Yes.
Right?
Now, you're talking about in a logical world.
In a logical world, because, I mean, for instance, what happened, like, to me and the CBOE, when it happened to me, happened to a lot of people. When I started, again, this is going off the reservation here, I'll be very brief because I want to talk about these tariffs because I got a page up here about who they affect. And you could lease a seat or you could buy a seat. Well, the seat was only good for you to be on the trading floor. I mean, it was not considered an investment by people. Well, it was if you bought a seat and leased it, you got a little better return than if you put it in a bank, a little better.
Right.
So, but the idea
but
that
that's what it should be.
The way over a period of time, now the people that owned a couple seats. There's nobody trading. Okay, there's a few people trading. But now all of a sudden you become this ownership crap where you can charge the world for quotes and things like that, and you become this organization. Somehow the Fed has allowed you to morph into. I mean, the Board of Trade doesn't make... I don't know if they make... They don't care if anybody trades anymore. They charge... If we have five people at PTI, every single machine that gets quotes to the Board of Trade is $350 a month. And what the bleep is that? But can this conversation... Because you're going to get me going here. But I got this article here from somebody. This is from Money Watch, CBS News. They're talking about the different... Now, it's a 25% tariff on vehicles and auto parts imported into the U.S. The new duties could lead to a sticker shock in a wide range of automobiles, blah, blah, blah. For a vehicle, now they're talking about people that could be sort of spared or not. They're saying Tesla is expected to be that are least affected, but they are affected because they import a lot of the parts.
Right.
The same thing, but then are the batteries made here or no?
Well, so kind of. So this is the sourcing. The question isn't the battery. The question, because making a battery is an assembly job, right? You take lithium and cobalt and you make batteries. Right? And Tesla has set up factories to make batteries. Why? Well, because they kind of smelled the problem coming with, well, we make them over in China. What happens when China decides they don't want to sell them to us anymore?
A short question. The announcement the other day that Chinese, they've invented a battery you can charge up in 5 minutes, is that remotely true?
It may be, okay, it's been worked on for an awfully long time. There are a number of very serious issues that get raised with such a device and technology. Essentially, the corner case problem with doing that is that in order to be able to charge something that fast, the internal resistance has to be extremely low because as you put current through something, resistance causes heat. Okay, so that's an inefficiency in that you put in so many watts and you have an internal resistance, and that resistance means that some of the energy you put in gets dissipated as heat. In order to increase the charge rate, you have to drop that down.
Well, they also didn't mention whether you're talking 120, 220, 440, or whatever.
Well, you're talking about extremely high voltages because otherwise the size of the wires that you have to use is ridiculous. Okay, so that's the other thing is that, watts is volts times amps. So
what's the most you can get off the tower in the house, 440?
Your service at your home is 240 split phase.
Right, so you get two 120s you could yoke to be a 240.
They're exactly opposite in phase, so you can. That's why your dryer is 240.
Right. But what's now, what's on the tower? 440.
Well, it depends. Well, no. What's on the tower is depending on the distribution systems, frequently 7,200 volts.
No, I'm talking about. I say the tower. If you look behind your house,
right.
There's a can up there. The can is a transformer.
Yeah, the can's a transformer.
I thought that took it from 440 down to whatever.
Oh no, typically considerably
more net, okay.
Higher than that. Yeah, but the thing is that
the system is balanced and built in such a way that you are not going to get 400 or 700 volt service or whatever.
You need a transformer just for you.
Well, 440, industrial users sometimes take power at 4800 volts. I mean, it just depends on what you're doing and where you are. But there's the safety issues with that get pretty profound pretty fast. So there's a problem with that, and that's one of the things that comes up.
The reason why I know a little about this enough to be dangerous, real dangerous.
Well, here's the
train car. I think starts out from the locomotive at 440, then it gets broken
correct.
Down.
Yeah. But here's where the challenge is with a battery, a solid state battery that has extremely low resistance and therefore can take charge at stupidly high rates, all right, without exploding because of the heat. The problem is if there is a short in that pack, all that energy gets discharged at that same extreme rate at once. Now, we think of electrical things that go wrong as being fires. I got news for you. At extreme rates of current, it's not a fire, it's an explosion.
Well, yeah, man, even if that could be theoretically possible, I can't believe that you pull over to the side of the road and somebody have that kind of power to charge it up that fast. Whatever, that'd be one hell of a system.
Well, that's the other problem. Yeah. Is now where do you get the energy feed at the so-called filling station?
Well, that's right, what I mean, yeah.
Plug? Yeah, I mean, these are... Good God! I mean, you start running the math on that, and the corner gas station. There isn't enough energy available in the distribution network at the corner gas station to be able to put five of these or 10 of these pumps there, right? These cords to fill these things. Then you get into the problem of what size wire does that have to be? And again, that comes down to the voltage, the safety protocols, and issues that go along with stepping the voltage way up in order to get the wire size to be reasonable.
A big deal.
All I'm saying is this has been worked on for an awfully long time, and nobody's really been able to show me that that this is practical. So let's see it. I'm not interested in what China says. I'm interested in what they can deliver. When they can deliver it, I'll look at it.
All right, these guys say that General Motors is one of the so-called big three. Headquartered in Detroit, the U.S. car company makes just 45, it must mean it assembles, 45% of its vehicles that sells to U.S. consumers domestically, leaving 55% of its lineup exposed to tariffs, according to Cox Automotive.
Yep.
So they're heavily invested in Mexico and Canada, which I think we sort of knew.
We knew that, yes.
Which, by the way, since we have a North American free trade agreement, this is not something that is a sin for these guys, right? I mean, it's not like...
In theory, it's not, right.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be...
By the way,
Trump signed the damn thing, so it's not like...
Well, the second one, right. The first one was stupid. The second one was equally stupid.
So now we talked about Stellantis. I still think the reserve my name for Chrysler, but I guess that's a dodo. Brands include Jeep, Chrysler, Dodge, and Ram. Is similarly susceptible to rising costs. It makes between 73% and 75% for sale in the U.S. So they've got some. This means a... $80,000 Ram truck for Stellantis made in Mexico could cost $100,000 once you reach here. The impact is quite large because their stuff's pretty expensive. I mean, there's $100,000 Jeeps, for God's sake.
Well, they don't. Well, they essentially have gotten out of the car market. So pretty much all they make is trucks now.
Yeah. So now it says here Ford is better positioned, according to Cox Automotive. 80% of its vehicles are manufactured in the U.S., therefore, would not be subject to the 25% tariff on passenger cars. However, any imported parts. Using Ford now because the parts are involved in this stuff here too.
Correct.
I mean, this is like one of the places I saw it was going to be really affected is a BMW assembly plant in Mexico. Now, are those transmissions and motors made in Germany? Are they made here? Are they made in Mexico?
There was a whole thing when I bought my TDI Jetta. It was a German car too, right? The one that I bought was assembled in Wolfsburg and put on a ship. The gas ones were assembled in Mexico, and the difference in quality, I assure you, if I had bought one of the gas ones, it wouldn't still be on the road.
Toyota and Honda, they import a lot of their stuff from Japan, obviously. and they have huge assembly facilities in Canada, so they're going to be real affected. BMW and Volkswagen, German, make Audi, both operate big plants in Mexico. I think BMW's got a plant here, though, too, don't they? Somewhere?
There's, yeah, well, they're all, so there's, you know, there's always been these threats and games, and so, but it's, I mean, you look at, like, Hyundai, for example, you know, has very large assembly plants here in the United States.
Mercedes sending engines and transmissions from Germany to a plant in Alabama.
Yep.
Where the company, they make all their SUVs there, I guess, or they assemble them. I have to keep saying
put them together, right.
Yes. 25% tariff will likely apply to fully assembled Mercedeses coming in from Germany. So there you have it.
Right.
Now, at the end of the day, I think we're talking $5,000 to $8,000 more per car, and the government ends up with some more money. And I think Trump, in his mind, boy, I hate to help put myself there, he thinks this is going to get him enough money to not only extend the tax cuts to eventually rich people, and maybe even go further. I think he thinks that's the math. I don't see that as the math. But
well, I think, well, as I've pointed out, from an inflation perspective, tariffs are always precisely neutral because they decrease the deficit by the exact amount of the person who pays them, which is, of course, the person on the buying end of whatever it is. So it is, now, what you want to have happen is, okay, so it's neutral in the immediate term, although it certainly screws some people, right, who have to pay the higher price. However,
you're screwing his voter, basically.
Well, but what you want to have happen is you want it to drive the manufacturing back into the U.S., which compresses the K, and that's good. Now, will it happen in a day? No, of course not. But is that the goal? Yes, it is, and in the process of committing that goal, you stop the inflationary impact of just printing money, of just, you know, hey, let's sell some more bonds. The deficit doesn't make any difference. We'll just sell more bonds. You know, it'll all be fine. Everything will work out perfectly well. It's only $36 trillion. So let's make it 50. And that's what they've done for the last, you know, how many decades now?
Well, anybody who thinks that if somehow or another Ram pickups are affected way more than Ford, that Ford is going to be a good little American and just pick up market share and keep their prices the same, I got a bridge for you.
Well, for sale. No, obviously that's not going to happen. Okay, yeah, I mean, everyone takes advantage of the circumstances they're handed, right? I mean, that's you know, never not been the case. But the goal here, and I agree with the goal, I'm not so sure that I like the analysis behind the way it's being reached, because I don't know that there's that much of it.
That's what I'm saying. I don't think there is much.
I don't know if there's that much analysis that's going into this. I mean, if you put me in charge of it, there sure would be. But, you know, nobody's asked me.
Well, I mean, I'm just going to, and we got a dash here pretty soon, but nothing that has happened in the last 100 days would have caused me as a executive of General Motors to go out and start looking at more property to build a plant. It's been so back and forth, to the point where...
Well, that's exactly the problem, is it's threats rather than acts, and then, oh, well, you know, but we'll back off on this. You that is wrong if you actually want to drive change.
Yeah, and I don't know that... you say that... You can't bind the next Congress or something, but after a period of time, I mean, I think an awful lot of people thought that a North American free trade agreement was a pretty good idea.
Except all it's done is screw people.
Well, I'm not so sure it has. I don't think it screwed people vis-a-vis Canada. It screwed people vis-a-vis maybe Mexico, because the cartels are in charge of stuff that we don't want to be in charge of.
Well, no, I think it's screwed Americans.
I don't. How does it screw Americans with Canada? Their pollution laws
because
are the same.
Because it screws Americans that would have the jobs here that don't. They're in Canada. The arbitrage is there. You may not be able to personally identify it. I can't personally identify it, but I guarantee you it's there, because that's why the structure that is in existence is there. It would not be there otherwise.
I don't think that
Chief, I don't put things on a ship or a truck
or a train or whatever and move them around unless it is to my economic advantage, including the cost of moving the stuff.
I think this is somewhat. I don't understand necessarily why the people in Mexico have not ended up being paid as much maybe as they should have over time. Well, I mean, they got political pressure and gang pressure. And well, then corporations have more power down there.
Very simply, why would anybody believe that that the human factor that has always been present would suddenly be voided because somebody was a Friedman acolyte?
Well, the idea is people have always been able, in our existence, and I would include Canada there, people aren't working for $3 an hour in a Ford plant in Canada, are they?
No, but there is an arbitrage, there is a labor arbitrage, because I'm pretty sure it's not environmental with Canada. Canada has, you know, pretty much the same sort of environmental standards as we do, if not even tougher. So it's got to be a wage arbitrage thing, and I know some people that have said, yeah, there's definitely a game going on with regards to the labor force in Canada, and that's the reason for it.
There might be somewhat of an arbitrage between the medical stuff here, you having to pay for people, and up there it's somewhat included.
Well, it's hey, listen, cost is cost, right? When I look at bringing somebody on, it's not just how many dollars an hour I pay them; it's their total laden cost.
Well, it's another reason why, you've talked, better than anybody on the show. Our Achilles heel in this country is our medical stuff,
and you got to fix it.
And you got to fix it because, the other part is what this group is doing, and I'm going to lob this one out there. Their view is, let these people die. I mean, we're not going to pay for it. Well, so what if this person doesn't have any Medicaid? So what? They should have a job. Fuck them.
Well, the other side of it, though, is that, okay, so you get cancer, we'll fill you full of something that we have.
By the way,
doesn't work. By the way, you'll die, but not before we take $500,000.
Well, the people I'm talking about, they're not getting $500,000 worth of treatment.
Well, I'm just... All I mean,
you're fortunately out of Chicago now. You drive around, nobody's getting any treatment. Areas where nobody's getting anything.
Well, yeah. But the thing is, when you price people out, ultimately that's what happens, right?
They're totally priced out.
Yeah, they're priced out.
You're priced out on your deductible, for God's sake.
So guess what? So screw you, die.
That's people,
what it ends up being.
There's people that are priced out of their deductible on their meds. They're on Medicare with the insurance.
Chief, I said 30 years ago this was going to happen, okay, and that we had to fix this. It had to be stopped, and the problem is part of it is the human damage. The other part of it, though, is the industrial and the business damage, because when I go to hire somebody, I look at what is the total cost to have that ass in the seat.
I haven't asked my bro lately. I'll ask you. What would we be paying now if we hired 10 people in age 25 to 35 and got them a really nice plan? It's got to be $2,500 a month, isn't it?
For a young person with the Obamacare requirements which is just a cost shift, right? And that's basically a bottom line. You're paying for the drunk's medical care when he's got a bleeding ulcer because
I get it. I mean, but what's the number? At one point, we were the worst... The worst spot, we had like three women of childbearing age and three guys that were older.
I had people in my office that were under $100 a month to cover. They were young adults, okay, but they were under $100 a month, and we had pretty good insurance.
You know what?
You want to know something? You have to put at least a zero on that now.
Oh, without a doubt.
Right, and probably zero and change.
When I started on the trading floor, when you became a market maker and put, I had 10 grand in my account when I started and walked down to the floor, they first stop picked up my insurance. It was included before I'd made my first trade. And if I hired you as my clerk, you could have a family of 12. Guess what my number was for you with the family?
What?
$75.
Yeah, I believe that. Yeah. Well, like I said, I mean, we had two options. We had individual and we had family, because that was all you could do, right? I mean, ERISA's got some weird rules.
And well, I don't know if those have changed because it's been 30 years since I've had to pay attention to it. But there are some weird rules in the way that works in terms of deductibility as an employer.
I didn't know any of that stuff. I just was trading. But
I had to deal with it. All right.
Yeah. We did it. You know, we do here at PTI too. But
yeah.
My point is, I think now if you have something wrong with you, specifically, obviously you're better off being sick now than you were in 1981. But the care, I think, was way better in 81.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No, it's we are this is the issue that drives a lot of this arbitrage. And if we kill it, then in first world nations like Canada, the arbitrage goes away because it's no longer economic.
Right. Well, we got a day. We'll pick this up on Tuesday. But the more I axe around, I don't know very many people that have a doctor.
Chief, I'll tell you what. Here's the thing: if people actually get into their heads in the markets that this is really going to take effect, it's not bluster and BS and extortion, but it's real. I think, boy, oh boy, are you going to see a repricing?
I think we might too. I'm not really positioning people there, but we're keeping our puts kind of close.
I've got a lot of dry powder because I'm looking forward to it if it happens. But I think that's a higher probability.
I just don't want to lose anything on the way down for people because they still want to be a little longer.
I think it's higher probability than that we muddle our way through this thing because otherwise the whole thing blows up.
Yeah. I do too, but we'll see. SP futures down 26, NASDAQ futures down 126. Been leaking a little bit here. Back on Monday, Stocks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.